You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Monday, June 13th, 2011, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Buonanotte.
Buonanotte, is that what you're trying to say?
Yeah, is that? I didn't know you spoke.
It was close.
I didn't know you spoke Portuguese, Steve.
Portuguese. Evan's like boner note.
We're a classy bunch.
You totally effed up the Chinese last week.
No, I didn't.
Didn't you get that email?
I got feedback from someone.
Did feedback.
Is that what you call that? Feedback? Angry?
Yeah. So the emphasis on one of the syllables was off a little. So I said, you know, throw me in prison instead of good evening in Chinese. So what's the big thing?
Throw me in prison.
All right, Evan, tell us about this day in skepticism.
This day in skepticism. Well, do you know what today is? Today that you're listening to this, most likely, is June 18th. And June 18th is International Panic Day.
Evan, don't they want you to not panic?
Well, that's a good question, Jay. No one really knows where the day originated, but some people take it as a day in which everyone can just kind of freak out about whatever it is that keeps them up at night. Or
what do you mean? No one knows where it originated?
Well, that's what
it just exists.
Told me.
What a stupid holiday to just exist.
It does. It does just exist.
Right.
But it does, you know. What are you going to do? Don't panic, Rebecca.
Okay.
Don't
I'm kind
panic.
Of panicking about this.
Don't panic, right? And where have we heard "Don't panic" before? It's on the cover of some book. Called the something
Skeptic's
Guide.
Guide to the something or other.
Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Mm-hmm. I've heard of that.
Who played the voice of the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy in the film? Do you remember?
Stephen Fry.
Oh yeah, yeah.
That's what I just said.
Did you? Oh, yeah.
Jeez.
Well done, Rebecca.
Is this thing on?
God. That movie was disappointing. Maybe I should watch it a second time now that I know what to expect. I had high hopes for it.
Well, how could you not? I mean, you know, it's Hitchhiker's Guide.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Doesn't the Hitchhiker's Guide itself, the actual guide, remind you of what an iPad kind of is today? If you take a look at it, kind of this thin little notebook thing, and you kind of have all these buttons.
Yeah, I always kind of pictured it smaller than an iPad and a little bit thicker.
Arthur C. Clarke said Douglas Adams' use of "don't panic" was perhaps the best advice that could be given to humanity. What do you think of that?
Yeah, panic is not generally a very adaptive approach.
But it can be fun to look at.
Here you go, guys. Have a listen to this one.
So, Professor, would you say it's time for everyone to panic?
Yes, I would, Kent.
Yes. those voices are awesome.
So, happy International Panic Day, everyone.
Thank you,
however
Evan.
You choose to celebrate it.
Mm-hmm. Now, Evan, you're also going to tell us about the latest two new elements to join the hallowed periodic table.
That's right, Steve. There were two new elements officially added to the periodic table this month.
I'm going to have to update my shower curtain.
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
Awesome.
Draw them in.
It's the best shower curtain I've ever heard of, by the way.
The first one is called Evanonium.
If only.
If only
and
in them.
The second, if only in them. The elements were recognized by an international committee of chemists and physicists, and they're called elements 114 and 116, at least for now, until the permanent names and symbols become chosen at a later date. The elements were discovered years ago. The official recognition, though, was just announced last week. The experiments were done in 2004 and 2006, respectively. So it takes a long time for new elements to make their way officially onto the chart.
Right. They did have temporary designations, though. They can't be named until they're official. But a lot of the elements have designations as to, like, as placeholders. These were...
Yeah, they were kind of goofy.
Unum quadium and unum hexium.
Yep. Well, quad is 4 and hex is 6, so 14, 16.
I liked in one of the articles I read, they talked about how difficult it actually is to create these new elements. And they're talking about, you know, running experiments over the course of, I think, about a month and producing about a billion collisions. And after all that, you may get one or two indications that that something interesting might have been created. So it's a tremendous amount of work. And it lasts for a second. You know, some of these elements will last for a second. Like, so it's not like you could pull it out of your pocket and say, look at this new element I discovered. It's like, no. It's like, look at this 1,000 sheets of paper. And in within this data, there's 2 new elements that are indicated. Check it out.
Bob, apparently these elements occur for such a brief period of time, you're not even really sure that they can classify them as either a solid or a gas or a liquid
at
temperature. They're in the undefined category. And there are some of the other elements prior to them also fall under that category just because they're not around that long.
Is the idea, though, that they may exist somewhere, or is this a purely human-made reaction?
They're purely artificial. They do not exist in nature.
In fact, these 2 new elements were made by smashing calcium ions into atoms of plutonium and curium.
What does it tell us about the universe, though? I mean, if it's something that we made ourselves, I mean, what do we learn from it?
I think it's just good to know what combinations work, which can be considered elements. And the thing is, though, that everyone's thinking about, I think, is that the hope is that we're approaching what's called this island of stability, I think, where we may be able to create atoms that can last for a long time. And if we ever reach this so-called island of stability, that who knows what kind of novel properties could be made from material made out of these elements. So I think that's one of the big hopes.
But I think
we will reach that.
Even if we do reach an island of stability somewhere in the upper teens or 120s, I don't think it's going to be a stable element. I don't think anyone's thinking that. It's more that part of it is just the race to name these new elements, you know, to get somebody's name on the periodic table. But it's also just understanding the dynamics of nuclear physics, of how neutrons and protons and electrons interact with each other. And, you know, if we do discover an island of stability, it tells us something about the structure of nuclei and the interactions there. But yeah, the purpose is not to come out of this with, you know, unobtainium or something that's, you know, we could actually build stuff out of.
Although, but who knows? That's always possible. And that's the impression I got with the whole island of stability. That was something that could potentially, you know, if it lasts for an hour, that would be great. Then we could learn a lot more about it. But if it's actually very stable, then that would be pretty amazing. But then, Steve, it's funny you mentioned the whole naming it. One thing that I found very disconcerting in some of these articles, they were talking about naming rights. That was horrific. Can you imagine?
Yeah, I was actually going to make a joke about that earlier, and then I realized, no, that could actually happen.
Coca-Coleum.
Yeah. Pepsium, Viagram. It's really scary that
Home Depot-um.
Can you imagine, though? You discover this, and you get recognition because you discovered an element.
Right.
Then this company's like, here's $20 million. Let us name it. Like, oh, shit. I would like to think that I'd just flip them off and say, I don't think so.
But that hasn't happened.
A lot of dollars.
That hasn't happened yet. And
I don't think it will. I would be surprised.
I don't think it's going to
happen. I hope not. And I don't think there's going to be that many chances over the years. It's not going to be something that's going to be common. Guys, I got to mention somebody posted on my wall something that's kind of apropos. Alvaro Ibanez has said to me, he goes, if I ever discover an element, I'll name it Nanovellum in honor of Bob and because it sounds cool.
Nanovellum. Yeah,
I had to say that one.
So you got that going for you.
which is nice.
So when All you're right. decaying in the ground.
All right, let's go on. The decline effect was in the news again a few weeks ago. You guys familiar with this concept of the decline effect?
But the
I am since reading your blogs and your prior blogs about it, Steve, which were very, very
It's
good.
Interesting. So the notion is that effects in scientific research tend to decline over time. The term was first applied to psi research, to ESP, because of the notorious history of ESP research, where when researchers develop a new paradigm, a new way to demonstrate a psi effect, their initial effect sizes are large. But then as scrutiny is paid to their methods and the methods are refined and improved, the effect size declines until it eventually disappears and vanishes altogether.
That sounds exactly like studying pseudoscience.
Well, yeah, that's exactly right. So, but what's interesting is that the decline effect is not unique to pseudoscience or to psi research. It exists in science in general. that initial effect sizes, whether it's the clinical effect of a drug or any phenomenon that's being measured, also tends to decline over time, although they don't always vanish to zero. They often will then stabilize at a smaller effect than what was initially described. The question is, what's the cause of the decline effect? And there are two main categories of causes that you could think about. One is, which I personally think is the only category that is causing the decline effect, is that it's an artifact of research and publication. In other words, when researchers first discover a phenomenon, there's multiple forces in effect that would make it, that would exaggerate the size of the phenomenon. First, early research tends to be less well controlled for many reasons, partly because it's preliminary. So you're going to do smaller, less well controlled trials. You're just trying to see, is there something here? And therefore, the less well rigorously controlled a clinical trial is, or any kind of research study, the larger an effect of a researcher bias is going to have, right? So, you know, researchers are generally biased towards finding something interesting, and it's clearly established that when you have, say, a poorly controlled study, the outcome is not random. It's actually hugely biased towards the positive, towards what the researcher wants to find. In addition, there's also publication bias. In order to get a paper into the peer-reviewed literature, you want an impressive effect, you know. So perhaps smaller effect sizes are harder to publish, or researchers are less likely to really push publication if the effect size is modest. But if it's really impressive, they're more likely to push for it, editors are more likely to publish it, and therefore the initial publications will tend to be bigger. Then once the phenomenon is out there and people think, hey, this could be real, then papers that are either negative or show a smaller effect size are more interesting and relevant because it's now contradicting previously published results. So, and honestly, I think that's it. That's really all you need. And there may be other, you know, artifacts as well, but that's really all you need in order to explain why there would be this decline effect in general, and the most dramatically for things which don't really exist, like ESP, right?
Steve, I would argue that the decline effect is the process of science refining itself.
Yeah. I think it's just how science works itself out. Yeah, absolutely.
If there wasn't a decline effect, that would mean that we're not refining our data and not moving towards more accurate statements.
Right, but also it's the bias. Remember, because if it was just less accurate to more accurate, it could go in either direction. But it always seems to get smaller, and I think that's a reflection of the researcher bias and also data mining. You know, you notice an effect in the data if it's big, and then you publish that. Look at this big effect, but then that data was data mined and therefore biased towards there being a pattern that you notice. And then when you look at fresh data, it may not be real or it may be much more modest. So there's lots of things going on that would make it go in that direction from big initially to smaller later on. It's not just that the data is getting more precise.
If all research were to be published equally, Steve, yeah, would that eliminate the decline effect?
It would eliminate the publication bias component,
the publication bias
of it, decline, right, effect.
But it wouldn't eliminate the bias inherent in scientists themselves. And I think that's what Steve is saying. Correct me if I'm wrong, but that is most... the most probable cause for what's happening here is just that they're looking for an effect, and so they find it.
Yeah, I think there's data mining, there's researcher bias, and there's publication bias. Now, this is all coming up because a researcher named Jonathan Schooler wrote an article about this in Nature News. Not Natural News. Somebody made that mistake on my blog.
Whoa.
Natural News is that crank site by the Health Ranger. Nature News is actually part of the Nature Publishing Group. It's a perfectly legitimate outlet. He published an article in Nature News about the decline effect, and Schooler was writing primarily about the fact that if we register all studies and they get published online, they don't have to make their way into some prestigious print journal, but if they're all there, then that would at least eliminate the publication bias element of the decline effect. And he makes a good point in that while we can say generally what the probable components are of the decline effect, no one's measured them, because you would need to have access to all the unpublished data to know what a component that's playing. So he's saying the literature needs this. We need, in order to understand the literature, the evidence, we need to have this thorough registry of all studies and eliminate this publication bias that is distorting the data that's getting out there. And I totally agree with that. However, he also threw in this paragraph, which, again, to be fair, was not the focus of his article, but he did say this. He wrote, "Perhaps just as the act of observation has been suggested to affect quantum measurements, scientific observation could subtly change some scientific effects. Although the laws of reality are usually understood to be immutable, some physicists, including Paul Davies, director of the Beyond Center for Fundamental Concepts in Science at Arizona State University in Tempe, have observed that this should be considered an assumption, not a foregone conclusion." So he's saying the other thing, not that it's an artifact of the way research is done and published, but that it's a real effect law of the universe.
Oops.
Which is, he's saying not that it is, but that we don't know that it isn't. You know, we can't assume that it isn't a real effect, that the laws of nature don't subtly change as we try to observe them. Which,
is that kind of a relativistic kind of statement, right?
It's a crazy, I think, kind of statement. It's yeah. Also, it's what the Those ESP really guys have been saying to as their special pleading, get out of free jail free card, right? They're saying, but the decline effect's not our fault. It's real. It's a real effect of nature. These psi effects actually go away the more we try to look at them. It's something about psi.
But that doesn't work in chemistry experiments and other things.
But Schooler is saying it does. He's saying, well, not that it does, but he's saying, how do we know that this isn't just a property of the universe, that the more we try to look at and zero in on something, that it makes it shrink, the effect size shrink inside.
Yeah, and maybe the LHC was going back in time to stop itself from going online. It's really tough to tell, isn't it?
We're like dancing around this thing, but it's ridiculous.
Yeah,
it's
I don't think we were dancing around it.
I'm not trying to dance around it.
He's saying pretty clear.
The laws of reality may not be immutable. I think that what a huge leap to take, especially from the decline effect. The decline effect, we have these perfectly reasonable explanations for it in that I just went over. Let's not get crazy and start talking about the laws of reality. And
too late.
Until, when we exquisitely measured these effects, there was still something there. Although I don't know how you could measure researcher bias. You know, that's tricky. I'm sure there's some statistical thing you could do to sort of estimate its role. But, I mean, I don't know how you could measure it so precisely that you could say there's a real effect left over that we have to account for. But anyway, we're not even there.
Yeah. Maybe they could do something like the pain scale, 1 to 10 with the happy faces to the sad faces, Steve, and do a similar thing with the researcher bias.
Steve, when you think about the decline effect, I think that we have things that we're becoming more clear on, and some things disappear because the effect was initially thought to be much greater, and some things become more focused, and we have a stronger and more keen understanding of what they are and how they work. And I wouldn't say that's the decline effect. I would say that's the process of like filling in all the gaps.
It depends on what kind of thing you're researching. The more fuzzy it is, I think the more of a decline effect there's going to be. Let's
Absolutely.
Take, for example, the effect of antidepressant medication on depression. There is this generally observed effect in the literature that antidepressants work a lot better based on their initial studies than when they are later studied. The joke is, you better hurry up and use that drug before it stops working. But everyone knows that it's an artifact of the literature. They don't literally stop working. It's just that, you have to be appropriately skeptical of initial studies, And we know that there is researcher bias and funder bias, meaning that when pharmaceutical companies fund a study of their own drugs, they're much more likely to be positive than when they're independently funded. We can assume the same is true of everything, of supplements, of people studying their pet theories, of whatever. That's just generic researcher bias that's creeping in there. Mark Krislip said that his rule of thumb is that drugs are probably about half as effective as they appear to be in the initial research that gets them through the FDA. Which is probably not a bad rule of thumb, but because there's also subtleties in how the research is designed. And that's something that I didn't even mention, but I would add to the list, because there are lots of choices that you make along the way as to how to design a study. It's not always obvious or straightforward. For example, your inclusion and exclusion criteria. What people are you going to study the drug on? Now, there are some common sense things that we do. We don't want to study a drug on pregnant women, you know, because that's a variable that we don't want in there. And plus, we don't want to figure out in a clinical trial on humans that it causes mutations, you know, developmental problems in kids. And we don't want people to have too many other coexisting conditions or to be on certain other kinds of drugs that may interfere with our ability to measure the effectiveness of the drug. But also the outcome measures. You know, we choose the outcome measures that have the best chance of looking positive. And, you know, they may do some preliminary testing where they look at four or five different outcome measures. Then they pick the one that looks really good, and they use that in their big trial. So there's lots of subtle ways to tweak a trial so that it looks totally good on paper, but the process was all geared towards exaggerating the positive effect of the study. And then when it gets used in the real world on patients with every kind of disorder and other drugs and more real world outcome measures are being used, you can't expect that in the pristine and actually biased context of the clinical trial that the effect size is going to be the same. We know that. And that's actually the legitimate role of pragmatic studies. Once you take a treatment that's been proven to be efficacious, you then look at its real-world application because the efficacy trials are kind of contrived and artificial. They're that way so they can control for variables, but the price you pay is they're not real-world applications. Then you look at the real-world application. Of course, the abuse that we're now seeing from the CAM proponents is that they're bypassing efficacy trials and doing pragmatic studies, which are generally unblinded, and they're treating them as efficacy trials. That's an abuse of the research as well. So these things are all playing a role in the decline effect, and again, it just gets you back to the notion that starting to speculate about the laws of reality not being immutable strikes me as being kind of crazy.
But that's just you.
Yeah, but that's just me. Yeah. I think that's, when you talk to – the thing is, what's really interesting, when I talk to my colleagues not in the context of complementary and alternative medicine, that's what everybody thinks, right? This is just – we all understand the strengths and weaknesses of different types of research, and basically everyone's appropriately skeptical, right? But then in CAM world, it's like all bets are off. It's bizarro world of research and evidence and logic. It really is. It's totally insane.
It's amazing how it all reduces to zero, though, right? Hello? Clue there.
Oh, yeah, like in psi research and stuff? Yeah, just...
Yes.
Absolutely. Yeah, Steve, I mean, anybody that says anything and that their conclusion is the laws of reality are immutable. Yeah, you could pretty rule of thumb, kids, rule of thumb. Yeah, they're crazy. And you're pretty safe.
I think I always compare
Optum has something to say about that, yeah.
I always compare everything to a jet engine. Is a jet engine like functioning
everything?
Less as time goes by? No, a jet engine is a perfect example of science totally kicking ass.
Okay, Jay.
Come on. Well, if you don't maintain it'll change over time.
Well, yeah, it's a good example of something very concrete. You don't have to believe in the jet engine in order for it to work. Yeah, it doesn't, suddenly the principles don't stop working over time. You don't need some special ability to see that it works. Yeah, it's it works. It just works. Yeah.
And the Earth isn't going to be a cube tomorrow.
Right, exactly. All right, Jay, tell us about the guy who developed Zicam.
Mean Charles?
Charles.
I say.
Charles Hensley. Oh,
stop it, people.
He's the inventor of the zinc-based Zicam. And a lot of people have heard about this product, and a lot of people have used this product. This guy's made quite a bit of money selling Zicam. It's a popular over-the-counter cold medicine, and he's been recently arrested in Los Angeles for some very interesting shenanigans. Check this out.
Shenanigans.
He's being arrested for illegally importing and distributing another one of his products called Vira 38. He claims that it's a prevention and treatment of the bird flu. And he was basically selling this. He was importing it from Hong Kong, and he was selling it, and he did not have any FDA approval whatsoever on the medication. So the federal grand jury handed down a 12-count indictment against Hensley. Here's a few interesting details about the product. He started importing this roughly after the 2005 bird flu scare. And he tried to market it in Hong Kong before that, and it didn't work. He didn't have any sales, but he started importing it in the United States and distributing it to two states in the United States, and the sales started to percolate, and his business was taking off. Now, he has a company called PRB Pharmaceuticals, and their original claims about Vira 38 was that it was highly effective against the flu, and it can be used as a flu medication. It showed to inhibit and prevent the infection of the bird flu virus H5N1 and type A human influenza in vitro. He said that human clinical research shows Vira 38 reduces the duration of influenza illness by 78%. He said one of the antiviral components is V38AMF-1, which has been shown to inhabit infections from type A influenza, SARS virus, avian influenza virus, Staphylococcus.
Staphylococcus.
From Sesame Street. Right.
I love that word.
That word
is freaking awesome. I just want to tattoo that word to my face. Streptococcus, pneumoniae, two bacteria primarily responsible for secondary infection seen in influenza.
So it's good for bacteria and viruses.
That's right.
Cool.
Exceptionally. Vira 38 is a favorite among the Hong Kong doctors for the prevention and treatment of influenza, so the packaging said. Vira 38 is currently used in Hong Kong to protect the live poultry market workers against bird flu. And the last but not my least favorite, Vira 38 was used by the major SARS hospital to protect frontline doctors and nurses against SARS during the SARS outbreak in 2003. Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, everything you just heard is complete and total bullshit. All of those facts were made up. The current indictment alleges that Vira 38 was never approved by the FDA. He was illegally importing it from Hong Kong, distributing it in the United States. He was dispensing it as a drug without a prescription. And he could face up to a maximum sentence of 28 years in a federal prison. Now, Hensley's lawyer said recently that Vira 38 is made from, and I quote, 4 Ts you can find in any health food store. And that Hensley was going to plead not guilty to the charges, and he later commented that no one was harmed, and the lawyer asked, is this really worthy of a federal prosecution?
Absolutely.
Yes, Mr. Lawyer, yes it is indeed. Mm. You would know that if you paid attention in law school and didn't think about how you were going to help scumbags.
He knows it. Lawyers don't say things because they actually believe them.
Now, here's where the irony comes in, and this is my favorite part of the story. Without the labeling that they had on their package, they could have legally sold Vira 38 as a homeopathic supplement. So the problem was that he claimed that it treats disease, and you can't decide to take it upon yourself to say that anything treats any serious disease, particularly things like the bird flu.
Yeah. So remember, to put this into context, Zicam was sold as a homeopathic remedy.
And it turns out it wasn't, and ended up making some people lose their sense of smell.
That's right. It had actual active amounts of zinc oxide in it, which was enough in some cases to cause anosmia, or permanent loss of smell. So this guy, in my opinion, is a modern snake oil salesman. He's a patent medicine huckster. He's working the system, bypassing the regulation by, you know, selling something that's not homeopathic as if it is homeopathic, because then you can sell it without any regulation. In this case, he just stepped over the line and made disease claims, which you're not allowed to do, because that's how the FDA defines what a drug is. It's something you make disease claims for, or something that's already registered as a drug. But if you're trying to put something new on the market, which in my opinion is kind of crazy. I mean, a drug should be a drug and a supplement a supplement and, you know, water, water. But they're regulated based mainly on the kinds of claims you make for them. And the laws are crafted so that hucksters like him can flourish, and he still managed to screw up.
He's just like another Kevin Trudeau, the guy who did, things they don't want you to know about,
yeah.
weight loss secrets and yeah. things like that, where, you know, he's obviously spent a great deal of time trying to figure out how to bypass those, get through those loopholes, you know. But luckily, he's not doing a very good job of it.
Yeah, with the right. list of things that he said that the drugs do and where they're used and all that, it's crystal clear to me that people sat in a room and came up with these ideas. Once again, yeah. you know, the scumbag boardroom, you know, what are we going to say? You know, what's going to help our sales?
Jay, were they actually twisting their handlebar mustache when they were saying?
They have to be, Steve. As soon as you become a villain, the pop, that twisty, you know, mustache appears on your face, man. I mean, of course we all know that.
Right.
What about the fingertip pyramid of evil contemplation?
I love that. But Evan, you have to be spinning around in your red leather chair as you're doing it. You know, like you're looking out the window.
Or you have to have a feline on your lap.
That's right. That's the only for the high
muckety-muck
scumbag.
You'd have to couple that with the evil mwahaha laugh.
Or optional now is excellent.
Oh, God.
There you have it.
All right. Good. Well done, Jay.
Thank you.
All right, Bob, tell us about living lasers.
Well, just when you thought lasers couldn't get any damn cooler, the next potentially wicked type of laser may be a bio laser. Researchers have tweaked biological cells in such a way that they can actually emit monochromatic coherent light, amplified beams of light in which all photons are pretty much the same wavelength and in phase. In other words, laser light. How cool is that? That's pretty amazing. It reminds me, I don't know if you guys ever watched Guyver.
I did.
Which is an anime series that deals with a lot of bioweapons, including lasers.
Oh, I thought you were talking about MacGyver. Yeah.
Yeah,
makes planes out of matchsticks.
He made lasers out of his own cells.
Right,
he's cool, and he got the girl too.
So, Steve, Jay, you guys might remember this. This also immediately reminded me of Alan Dean Foster's book, Sentenced to Prism. Remember that?
Oh yeah.
But it was about somebody that goes to a planet called Prism that evolved this kind of weird combination of conventional carbon-based life and silicon-based life, including these crystal organisms that could somehow biologically produce these deadly laser beams when they were exposed to the sun. Yeah, obviously, I thought, really cool book. Check it out if you're into that kind of stuff.
Bob, do you remember when I was with Michael Whalen and I met him? We were having lunch. I didn't even know who he was.
Oh, my God.
And then Michael said, hey, remember in Sentence to Prism, which I had just finished like 3 weeks ago because Bob said read the book? Yeah. And then I'm like, I put it together. And I'm like, that's Alan Dean Foster. I couldn't believe it. Anyway, very cool. It was really cool, guys.
I bet.
Did you do the fanboy thing?
I have to admit, I did come back in and I'm like, dude, I just finished your book. I didn't even know it was you, and I loved it. And I started asking him all sorts of questions, and he totally didn't want to talk about it.
Oh my god!
Oh my god!
Yeah. So, all right, back to reality. So we've got Seok-Hyun Yun is an optical physicist at Harvard Medical School.
What'd you call me?
And he's one of the main guys behind this. He developed this living laser, they're calling it, which is pretty cool, with his colleague Malte Gather. So how do they pull this off? Well, you need to know there's a few key components that you need to have a laser.
Light?
Huh?
Light?
No. You don't need light. You don't need light to have a laser.
Sure
you need laser. No, that's what it produces. You could have a laser that's not producing light. So you need a lasing material. This is the material that amplifies the light, and it's called the gain medium.
Wait, it's amplifying the what?
Yeah, amplifying the light.
So you need light.
Yeah, you do need light. It's a light amplification SAR.
I'm talking about the physical components that you need. You don't need light to create a laser. That's what it makes. Hello?
Are you saying that light isn't physical?
Oh, boy. It's not part of the hardware. So I'm talking hardware, people. So...
Splitting hairs. Go ahead.
So what the gain medium does is the key thing you need here is what's called a population inversion. You introduce energy into the system and you have electrons going. Doesn't have to be. You create an inversion. What you want to do is you want to move the electrons from their ground state to an excited state.
Yeah.
And you want to have a lot of them. Woo-hoo. You want a lot of them in this excited state. And then when they go back down to the ground state, they emit photons that are the main components of the laser light. This is what the gain medium does. You want this material, and it could be really anything. It could be even a solid, a liquid, a gas, even a plasma. Typically, you'll find examples that are crystals or semiconductors or purified gases. You've heard of ruby lasers.
Yeah.
There you go.
Oh, yeah.
So that's
and slippers too.
That's one. Yeah. So that's one of the key components is this gain medium. But these are all synthetic materials. But now we have apparently we've got this new different class of gain media that's been created, and it's biological. And in this specific case, it's proteins. The researchers engineered human embryonic kidney cells to produce what's called GFP, or green fluorescent protein. And this is the substance that makes jellies bioluminescent. So they tweak these cells to produce a lot of these fluorescent proteins. And that's the key lasing material for this biological laser. Now, the other key component that you need for a laser is a way to reflect the light that has already been amplified in the gain medium back and forth to amplify it even more. And typically what you have here is you've got a mirror. You've got two mirrors on either side, but one of them is partially reflective. So you've got this energy. You've got these photons coursing back and forth, bouncing off the reflective surfaces back through the gain medium so that more photons and more photons are created. And eventually you reach a point where there's so much energy that it can go through one of the mirrors because it's partially reflective. The other one is a regular mirror. One of them is usually partially reflective. So at some point when there's enough energy created, it goes right through it and bam, there's your laser beam that's being created. Now, what the researchers did for this is they created a really tiny optical cavity and put one cell, this one kidney cell inside it that had the proteins.
Liver cell.
Liver cell inside it. Now, this micro cavity had two mirrors, has two mirrors on opposite sides that are like 20 millionths of a meter apart. I mean, this is really, really tiny. And then finally, you need a way to get energy into the system to start the process, and this is called laser pumping. In this case, the researchers made some kind of specialized microscope that could pump light into the cell to actually get this whole process started. So then when you put all this together, you got the cell with the fluorescent proteins, you got the reflecting optical cavity, and you pump the system with light.
You got to pump the light in there to make it work.
To make it work. Come on, this is semantic bullshit. So ended up with this beautiful green, visibly green laser light. Now it was obviously this was weak laser light. I mean, they're not creating this super powerful thing right off the bat, but they created this weak laser light when compared to conventional lasers. But it was about 10 times brighter than any natural jelly fluorescence. So clearly this is a really cool first step. So then the next question should be kind of, well, all right, cool. What the hell can they do with this?
Yeah, that's always the part where I think these reports go off the rails.
Well, I have here in my notes here, nothing at all. There's no conceivable applications for this. So,
well, they were talking about imaging tissue.
No, it goes off the rails because that's where speculation comes in.
I know.
Purely speculative. So yeah, it's going to go off the rails a little bit. But it's often the most fun part. So this new branch of laser tech could potentially be a boon for disease diagnosis, intracellular sensing, imaging, like Steve, you mentioned. Of course, there's also the potential for the obvious sci-fi application where you have a doctor turning on a laser within a cell to attack other cells, hopefully other diseased cells. So that's always the option as well.
Right? Hopefully.
Another way to look at this is that it could be used to get light-encoded information into and out of the body. You may have read a lot of science news about biologists using cells that fluoresce in test tubes. I'm sure you've seen hundreds of pictures of this, of these cool green or blue or red glowing cells that they're studying. And they use this to study cell biology. But typically, when you see these pictures, it's within a test tube. And because getting this light to pass through a human body is obviously pretty tough because the tissue just kind of diffuses the light and nothing comes out. So what they're talking about here is potentially, you know, imagine a hybrid implantable device that's made up of living and non-living matter that could beam out this information, so you can get information to
like
it and
bear.
Out of it, right?
or a Teletubby.
You could make a Teletubby. Awesome. So the big picture here is they're talking about bringing computation and optical communication into the realm of biotechnology
and television.
Television.
Thank you, Winky.
I predict that if it does have an application, it'll be none of the above. It'll be something no one's thought of yet.
Could be.
Bob, I love
how
you talk about these new technologies and new sciences and stuff.
Yeah.
And hopefully it all happens within the span of your life, basically.
Yeah, of course, because I don't care what happens after I'm dead.
Yeah.
Right, exactly. Well, like, boy, this would be great if this happened 100 years from now.
Because Bob's not a researcher. If this were Bob's research, he would say, and I think we could make this work with some really positive applications within the next funding cycle.
Hey, Rebecca, are you careful cool about effect. This research?
What?
If we couple this with some genetic engineering on existing animals, we can make unicorns that fart rainbows.
We could.
We could, yeah.
Or, sharks with lasers.
The possibilities are endless.
Absolutely.
Yeah, not attached to their heads, Evan. A part of their head.
Yes. Mm. Their heads will be a laser. Absolutely.
One up Dr. Evil, ha ha. Mm-hmm.
Well, Rebecca, tell us about the latest useless techno gadget from Japan.
Yeah, speaking of
science
organisms with interesting characteristics, there is a Japanese company that has recently shown, not for sale yet, but they've shown this set of cat ears that people can wear. And what they say is that the ears use brain waves in order to move the ears. And some articles, of course, reported on this as the ears displaying your emotions, things like that. So the ears can perk up if you're concentrating hard, and they will flop down if you're feeling, quote unquote, rejected. So it's adorable, and it's technological. And so, of course, it is in fact Japanese. My friend and fellow skeptic writer, Amy, Surly Amy, actually emailed the company a while back to ask if they were selling them at all, and they responded very politely and said, no, not yet. I guess they are overwhelmed right now with feedback. Yeah. And they said,
I guess all
their
ears are drooping down there.
Well, yeah, ours are, though, because we can't buy them yet. But they said that they hope to have them available for sale at the end of this year. But yeah, it has been probably a bit over. The reporting was a bit overly enthusiastic, I think, because they were saying things like the ears will convey your emotions, which
they're mood
I don't
ears
think is quite right. Yeah, mood ears. Yeah, they convey your emotions in the same way that a mood ring conveys your emotions,
yeah,
which is
not at all. Yeah,
but but they do.
But it turns funny colors.
They're like they remind me of. There's like a brain game you can get that's usually advertised in Sky Mall. That's the only place I've actually seen this, with a tiny plastic ball. And the idea is that you put on this headset and then you focus really hard until you can move the tiny ball, like it floats up, and then you can push it through a hoop.
Well, guys, it's not really that crazy that an instrument can read activity in the brain. It's just I don't think that the technology is cheap enough to put it into kids' toys and stuff like this, right?
Well, it is actually because this is a toy that you can purchase. That I mean, it's not that it doesn't read your emotions. It just picks up on brain waves that you generate by thinking, by concentrating. And Steve can go into this a bit more.
Yes,
but
I will.
But yeah, it doesn't. It's not like, oh, I'm feeling happy, and so that puts out a certain brain wave that the ears or whatever can pick up on and perk up. No, it's not quite like that.
No, I mean this is an entire category of pseudoscience that is very common, and you know, Evan and I, we were at the Connecticut Science Museum, and they had a similar device. Yep. I was totally disappointed. You know, where you tried to move the ball to one side or the other by concentrating, or like the game, or and now reading your mood. It's all BS. So there's only a few different states that your EEG, your brainwave, is going to be in when you're awake, and it depends more on whether your eyes are open or closed. Then the rhythm will change if you get drowsy, and of course, then there are different sleep rhythms. But there aren't different rhythms based upon how hard you're concentrating or on your mood or anything like that. That's all nonsense. And the other thing is that with these devices, the number of electrodes they're using is very little. So they're too crude even to get a good EEG, you know, which even if you had a really, like a clinical EEG, you couldn't tell somebody's mood or anything, or how hard they're concentrating by their EEG, let alone these two crappy electrodes you're going to get with these cat ears. So it's essentially going to, maybe it might reflect when you're drowsy. That would be about the only thing that it could do.
Right.
Otherwise, it's just gimmicky, yeah.
Yeah, and the thing is, I think it's a problem that it's being oversold, because I love things like that, like this. I love things that combine technology, science, and fashion and art. You know, and I've on Skeptic in the past, I've highlighted some really interesting work that's been done. Like, I wrote about a dress that had butterflies on it that's connected, and the dress itself is connected to the wearer so that the butterfly's wings flap, every time your heart beats. And, you know, and if you go on our new sister site, Mad Art Lab, of course, there's tons of this sort of stuff coming up all the time. So, I think the ears in and of themselves are actually still really cool, because they are talking about a specific type of science, and they are cool looking or cute, you know, in that sort of way that only small Japanese women can really get away with.
Yeah.
But
yeah, the video I saw, the girl was freaking hot with those ears.
Yeah. I mean, they're really cute, and they're very, yeah. I mean, if I could get away with that, I would totally wear them. But yeah, I think by overselling it like that, we miss an opportunity to actually talk about what the real science is behind it.
Yeah.
So, and I don't know, I hope that maybe a part of that is just a miscommunication because of the, I mean, if you go on their Facebook page or their website, it's all in Japanese. And so, and the email that Amy got back was not perfect English, so I'm thinking that maybe there's just a bit of a translation issue, and
they haven't
maybe
hired their American marketing company yet.
Yeah, well, I mean, they're not, as far as I can tell, they're not a huge company. I think it's just some people who figured out how to make these little ears, and now they got so much attention for it that now they're trying to produce them.
Yeah. Rebecca, did you think that the furries were going to jump on these?
Well, of course. I think everybody will. I think they're awesome.
They should make a tail that can, that, you know, read your your thoughts,
yeah,
right?
Where would that be connected to?
Yeah.
Your arse.
Why not just make the ears with this, with a switch that you could just like hit a button and how you wanted what the ears to do? I mean, that would be a lot.
Well, because that's not as cool. Like, the idea is it's picking up on your own body and, you know.
Well, yeah,
it's not.
But it, yeah, it's not working. That's the problem.
Well, yeah, it does. It does. It just doesn't work the way that the American news media is reporting it. It does, in fact, you know, pick up on brain waves and change.
You know,
and I think that's cool.
What would be better in terms of actually reflecting something about your mental state is to read your voice and then interpret your mood from your inflection and your tone and then and reflect that. That would probably.
It could also work similar to a lie detector, which, as we all know, doesn't actually detect lies all that well all the time, but it does detect stress. So, you know, it could be something that picks up on your heartbeat or your the amount of sweat you produce and produce a response that way.
It's like an emotional expression extender.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cool.
Yeah. We could just tell people what the hell's going on.
Well, it's like a crazy.
Remember talking.
Don't get out of control here.
Talking?
We're talking about people who spend all their time on the internet.
What are you, gay?
Our
Evans?
Listeners, I mean, not Japanese.
Talk to people. All right, let's go on.
So, Steve, it's been a year since our last Audible ad, and I wanted to let you know that I still use Audible. It's a great way to get audiobooks on your smartphone. I've been listening to Game of Thrones like crazy the past few months. I'm on book two now. I love it.
Yeah, Audible, that has a great selection of science books. I recently downloaded Michael Shermer's book, The Believing Brain. You can also get The Psychopath Test by John Ronson that we talked about recently on our show. What you can do is go to www.audiblepodcast.com/SGU and sign up for a membership, and you will get a credit for a free Audible download.
So, guys, get yourself some audiobooks and help support the SGU at the same time. We'd really appreciate it, and we think that you'd really enjoy Audible, so go for it.
Evan, it's time for Who's That Noisy?
Then I better play last week's Who's That Noisy so we can talk about it and reveal exactly what it was. And
do
here
it.
Here you go.
So, Kabbalah is actually an ancient Judaic mysticism, and I know you hear
That was a terrible recording, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it was.
I apologize for that. But in a sense, it helped
part
kind
of the
mask. Yeah, I didn't want the cleanest possible recording. Because, hell, let's face it, in life, you're not always going to hear things as clearly as you would like to.
Yeah, go with that.
Good recovery.
That's a beautiful life lesson you just
gave. Thank you.
God.
But listener Andre Costa from Brazil was the first one to guess correctly via email that that was Sarah Silverman talking about Kabbalah, and she was appropriately making fun of it during one of her funny, funny stand-up routines. So that was excellent work, Andre. Congratulations.
Yeah, she was making fun of Kabbalah. That's the key.
Yes.
She's not a believer like Madonna.
That's right. And a lot of people did guess that it was actually Madonna, but that, in fact, was not the case. Although that was a decent enough guess.
All right, you got something cleaner for this week?
All right, folks, here we go. This week's Who's That Noisy?
My mother.
Are you kidding me?
Would you like?
Evan, come
would
on.
You like a hint? Do you think the audience should get a hint with this one?
I have no idea. What's
all right,
go ahead. Do it. We've never done a hint before. Do a hint.
Well, occasionally we do, but all right, a hint. That was not an animal.
Okay, good. That definitely does help.
That's a good hint. Yes.
When right. you say animal, do you include human beings as animals?
Yes, I do.
So it's not a human being.
If you were to count animal, mineral, vegetable, you can eliminate animal from that.
Got it.
From those choices. All
interesting.
Right.
Interesting.
Give it your best guess. Good luck, everyone.
Right. So it's not a frog.
A frog is an animal.
That would be an animal, wouldn't
yes.
it?
Yes. Okay. Just checking. All right. Thanks, Evan.
You're welcome.
We're going to do one email. This one comes from George Vulgaris from Melbourne, Australia. And George writes, "Hi, guys. Love the show. Longtime listener. Despite being a skeptic, ever since I can remember, I find myself partaking in this superstitious act of knocking on wood only very occasionally and usually when an unpleasant thought involving my kids or family pops into my head. Most often, this will occur when my guard is down, such as when I am drifting off to sleep, for example. I know it's stupid and irrational, but during these moments of vulnerability, I am sometimes compelled to do it. Is this just a coping mechanism to get rid of the unpleasant thought, or is there a believer buried in my subconscious trying to get out? This led me to ponder whether belief in a higher power could have a subconscious component and where these occasional lapses in rational thought would be coming from. Am I a closet believer, or is this just a learned behavior, or could it be some type of repressed, redundant evolutionary remnant? Wondering also if you guys have ever partaken in any superstitious activity recently. Kind regards, George."
Yes, there is a believer buried in your subconscious.
Inside every skeptic is a believer trying to get out.
Trying to get out. I have a friend who does this exact same thing. He knocks his head when he says knock wood, and he does it on kind of a regular basis. And I asked him about it once, where he got it from. And he said, like, his uncle did it when he was a boy, so he felt it was like a cultural kind of thing in his family, so he just kept doing it. He has no particular belief that it really does anything, but it's just sort of his own personal colloquialism.
And that said, you know, if there's things like that can just be, you know, just a weird sort of habit that you learn and get into. But if you are doing it because you feel... If on some gut level you feel concern for a loved one in that, and you know, also on that level you somehow think that maybe that could help, but then rationally you realize it can't, then that's normal. Yeah, everybody, you know, there's no such thing, I think, as a true pure skeptic who doesn't occasionally have feelings like that. You know, it's not like you're burning a witch to make them go away or anything. You're just engaging in a harmless little outlet.
It's a ritual.
How do you know she's a witch?
Yeah. Plus, look at what he says in his email is important, I think, is that often it's when he's drifting off to sleep, when your defenses are really down. And it usually involves his kids or his family. So these two things that just set it up perfectly where, you know, you set up this mental thought. There's a lot of stress, and you're like, just, you know, just knock on the wood, and it kind of evaporates. So, you know, I could kind of, I could see that. You know, it's just some habit. It's also more of a habit than anything else, I think.
Well, from a neurological perspective, he's, in my opinion, literally correct in that, yes, there is a little believer down deep inside your brain in the more primitive bits where the things from which superstitions and emotions flow and that do highly motivate us. And then we have the rational frontal lobe parts of the brain, the hierarchically higher part of the brain, where we can't think in a more rational way about what we feel and what we believe and what we do. And it is a high energy part of the brain. And in fact, there are studies, there was just recently a study published, in fact, that showed that when you're sleep deprived, you're more likely to give in to bad food choices. So to temptation.
So that explains it.
Yeah, to temptation. So it takes energy to resist temptation. And even when you know you should or should not do something, that part of your brain that will inhibit the more primitive parts of your brain from doing what it wants to do takes concentration and energy. And if your guard is down because you're sleep deprived or you're falling asleep, or there's also an effect where if you just made a huge effort to resist something, you're more likely to cave into the next thing. You've already sort of expended your energy resisting temptation. Now your shields are low. You treat yourself, you know, to, it's like, oh, I just did this huge thing. I'm going to have the damn cheesecake, you know, or whatever. So
now that is so freaking cool. That explains so much to me. For real, though. Think
case
about
closed.
Right.
And, no, you know, now I have true. To, now I just have to make sure I don't use what Steve just said as an excuse. Oh, right. Well, you know, Steve just said that, you know, I'm tired, so therefore I can't resist all this food.
But it's good to know that, you know, that when you're going to be vulnerable, and it's neurological. You do have a finite amount of cycles in your head of energy that you can expend to do stuff. And if you've spent it on something else, or if you have less of it because you're sleep deprived or you need to go to sleep, you behave differently. You'll have less resistance. You know, that's the way it is. It's neurological. So his email was actually quite insightful. He really captured the neurological essence of the interplay there.
Good email.
Yeah, good job, George.
I think we have lots of little things like that we do, and I'm sure that there's a ton of them we don't even recognize. Like everything from like the way I put my keys in my pocket in the morning when I'm leaving for work.
Yeah.
And, you know, rituals on you know, how I go into the – I swear to God, like in the bathroom, like I have a way that I walk into the bathroom.
That's just OCD, Jay.
Yeah. Well, I definitely have a shower ritual, and it's totally subconscious, but I go through the same exact process every time because you've done it a million freaking times in your life. You know, it's like there's no surprises in store. It's like, oh, I think I'm going to do it this way today. You know, you just do it without thinking.
I don't know that – I wouldn't really consider ritual a sort of irrational – thing to do, an irrational behavior. But I do often talk about this. It comes up a lot at talks for some reason that I give. Usually during Q&A, someone will say something along the lines of, you know, this us versus them kind of mentality. They'll speak from this idea of how we're skeptics and they are believers and, you know, never the twain shall meet. And I like to point out that there are tons of weird little beliefs that, you know, even skeptics have that we don't really think about on a day-to-day basis. And I usually mention Bruce Hood's book, Super Sense, because he talks a bit about these sort of things. And also Dan Ariely's book, Predictably Irrational. Just to give you a quick example, the easiest one to throw out there is the idea that most people, if asked, will try on a sweater for if you offer them $10 to try on a sweater, they'll do it. But if you tell them that the sweater was once owned by a serial killer, a large portion of them will not do it. And that includes a large portion of skeptics, even skeptics who are right now thinking, well, yeah, $10, it doesn't matter. I would put it on. I think a lot of people still have that gut reaction where you're like, oh, Charles Manson wore that sweater.
You know, I don't have that, but you know what I have the opposite, where if there is an item that was used by a person I respect, then it's like, ooh, that's Darwin's microscope, you know.
Right.
Who cares? Yeah, it's still a piece of, you know, of wood and glass or whatever, but The historicity thing is the thing that I, even though I know there's nothing really different about the molecules in that microscope, there is a connection to the person who used it, which I think is actually quite reasonable.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's completely irrational, though, in its way, because what we're doing is we're imbuing this inanimate object with an essence that, you know, really is just, it's just completely in our minds. And,
yeah.
You know, along those lines, there have been studies done that show, if you take a child's favorite toy, and you convince them that you have a machine that will duplicate it atom for atom, you know, exactly the same way, and you offer them the duplicated item in exchange for their original item, they will not accept it. And it's because the original item has this essence that they give it that the duplicated item simply can't duplicate.
But that's a little bit different, though. I mean, that experiment that you just described is true. Again, that's from Bruce Hood's book. But you could see that as that's only with their special favorite toy, not with any toy. With regular toys, yeah. They happily take the exact duplicate because they recognize it's exactly the same.
Right.
But with their special toy, they treat it as a living thing. And
agency.
Yeah, they think it has. They do. They treat it like a living thing. And think about it. I mean, a parent should care that they get their actual child back and not just a similar-looking child. So you could see how evolutionarily we would evolve to behave that way, right?
Right, and people do it, even adults do it with inanimate objects, like with, say, a pocket watch that your grandfather gave you. If someone were to offer you the exact same pocket watch in every detail, you would probably not exchange it. You would want the original.
Sentimental value.
My final word on this point is there's nothing wrong with it. You know, be human, be happy.
Don't
sweat it.
Yeah, it's embracing the human condition. And, you know, you experience the emotional part of being human.
Yeah.
As long as you understand where it fits in and you don't let it control your life, you know. Well, let's go on with science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fictitious, and I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. We have a theme this week.
Oh boy.
The theme is Vesta. Do you guys know what Vesta is?
It's a moped.
That's what I wear under my jacket.
It's the opposite of Easter.
And
I can't top those.
Can you use any of these, Steve? I don't know.
No. Vesta is an asteroid in the asteroid belt. NASA's Dawn probe is on approach to Vesta and will be there this summer in July.
Is it going to land on Vesta and come to Resta?
It's going to orbit it very closely.
When it takes a break, is it taking a siesta?
I'll tell you more about it after the answer. These are the three things about Vesta. Ready?
Okay.
Oh, God.
Item number one. Despite the fact that Vesta has no clouds or snow cover, it is the brightest object in the asteroid belt with an albedo about the same as the Earth.
A libido.
Item number two, about one in every 20 meteorites that fall to the Earth come from Vesta. And item number three, when it was first discovered in 1807, Vesta was thought to be a moon of its larger cousin, Ceres, which was initially designated a planet. Evan, since you piped up, you get to go first.
Uh-huh. Just because I made the crack about libido?
Or
was it all those horrible jokes prior to that?
Well, you know.
Some combination. So it's a scientific fact that Vesta has no clouds or snow cover, according to this.
I think we can concede that.
It's the brightest object in the asteroid belt with an albedo about the same as Earth. Yeah, of course. All right. So therefore, what makes it bright? If it's not clouds, if it's not snow, it could be, if it's metallic-y, right? It could shine very brightly depending on how much metal is perhaps in this meteorite. About this object. And then the second one was one in every 20 meteorites that fall to the Earth originate from Vesta. How are they able to determine that? One in every 20 meteorites. I mean, there's a lot of meteorites bombarding the Earth constantly. How could they possibly know? And most of them, I guess, could be a trick, because do the little sand grain particles count as meteorites? I think they do. But if they burn up entirely, how could they possibly know? So I don't know about that one. And then the last one is when it was first discovered way back, over 200 years ago, was thought to be a moon of its larger cousin, which was initially designated as a planet. Its Ceres is a dwarf planet by our current classifications, and Vesta was thought to be a moon of it. Yeah, I don't see why that wouldn't be the case. That seems very reasonable, even though the classification of Ceres was initially partially incorrect. So the one that is making the least sense to me is about the meteorites. I don't know how they measure one in every 20 meteorites falling to the Earth, so I'm going to say that one's fiction.
Okay, Bob?
All right, the first one, it's got a very high albedo. Yeah, I mean, sure, why not? Depending on exactly its composition and how it's arranged, yeah, it could have a high coefficient of reflectivity. It could. I just don't know about the albedo of anything in the asteroid belt, so it could be. The second one about 1 in 20 meteorites coming – yeah, I agree with Evan. I'm not sure how the hell they could possibly determine it. The micrometeorites that burn up, I mean, yeah, obviously they don't count because they don't fall to Earth. But still, how could they possibly determine that? I mean, are they looking at the reflected light off of Vesta, trying to determine the composition? Man, I don't know about that one. And this third one's killing me too. I mean – that doesn't make a hell of a lot of sense either. Ceres is the largest asteroid in the asteroid belt. It's I think it's 100. Is it 100 miles? But so it's the biggest one. But I mean, the asteroids in the belt are so spread out. I love in the movies they show asteroids really close together, which is really silly because I mean, they would, and they're all moving moving in different directions too. So it's kind of silly because very soon after that everything would be so far apart. How did they just happen to get? What did the planet just explode?
Oh, the Death Star.
Minutes before
right.
they got there.
Yeah.
So, if you were on one asteroid in the asteroid belt, you couldn't even see the next asteroid. This is so far. It's just so far away. So I'm not sure why they would think Vesta was a moon of Ceres. Just a little bit of observation would tell you that it's not in orbit around it. But then again, it is 1807. That's going back a ways. Hubble wasn't launched yet, but still. So 2 and 3 are killing me here. All right, we'll go with the 1 in 20 meteorites then.
Yeah.
Okay, Jay.
I'll go with the meteorites.
All right. Very insightful, Jay. Rebecca?
Is that what everybody's gone for so far, the meteorites?
Yep.
Yes.
All right, then I'm going to be different. I don't know anything about Vesta. I don't know anything except for that it's big and important.
Join us.
So, no, I'm not going to go with the meteorites. I am going to go with the fact that it's thought to be a moon of Ceres. I know that Ceres is, in fact, big. But I don't think they would have thought that Vesta was a moon of it.
Ceresus.
Okay, so you all agree that despite the fact that Vesta has no clouds or snow cover, it is the brightest object in the asteroid belt with an albedo about the same as Earth. You all think that one is science, and that one is science.
Oh, thank goodness.
Hooray.
All good so far. yeah, so that is true. Vesta is a very bright object. The albedo of Earth is about 40%. It reflects about 40% of the light that hits it back, and Vesta is about the same, and they have no idea why. So the hope is that the Dawn probe, when it gets a close look at the surface of Vesta, will figure out why its albedo is so high.
The Dawn Treader. Mm.
That's it. So we'll take these in order, I guess. Mm-hmm. About 1 in every 20 meteorites that fall to the Earth come from Vesta. Rebecca thinks that one is science. The rest of you, the guys, think that one is the fiction. And that one is science.
Oh, how did they know? Whoa.
Good job, Rebecca.
Yeah, that was... That was a very interesting one. When I read that, I'm like, whoa, really? It wasn't so much that they knew, because, you know, we could figure out pretty much, you know, from looking at the chemistry and everything, you know, which rocks are asteroids, which ones come from the moon, which ones come from Mars. You know, we could figure that out.
You're talking about recovered stones?
Yeah, recovered. Yeah, so meteorites, Evan, by definition, have to be on the surface of the Earth. Yeah, they have
to
be.
Yeah, we don't know anything about the ones that weren't recovered.
Yeah, if they complete. Well, the term meteorite refers to something on the Earth.
Yeah, that's why I got confused.
It's a meteor when it's in the sky. It's a meteorite when it's on the ground.
So then meteorites that fall to Earth is redundant?
Yes. I guess so, unless it could be a meteorite that falls to the moon. Okay, you're still a meteorite if you hit the moon?
Well, that's a philosophical question that we
must
have to the
meteorite. Okay, all right.
Plate with something.
So... But the 1 in 20, why would 1 in every 20 meteorites that hit the Earth be from Vesta? What do you guys think?
Because it's big.
It's second biggest asteroid. Why aren't more coming from...
That's the second biggest asteroid.
Ceres, or the moon, or Mars. I mean, why so many from Vesta?
What could be... Is there a debris cloud from Vesta from the past that
yes,
we just go through? I mean, that's what I said.
It's not that we're going through a debris cloud from it. It's just that Vesta got whacked... It got smacked, and there's a massive crater on its south pole, and it just littered the entire solar system with debris. And so a lot of it falls to the Earth. Hmm. I don't think that we're passing through it especially. It's just that it's all over the place.
I was thinking more of like debris trails from like comets that we go through causing the annual...
Yeah, no, it's not that. It's just that it just...
Yeah,
it got smacked and threw up a huge cloud of debris that is just now just spreading throughout the solar system and occasionally falls to the Earth. Right. So that one is science. That's cool, I thought.
Do you think, therefore, that 1 in 20 meteors are also derived from that cloud?
Why not?
I guess you could speculate.
Well, it's different because
meteors
are, yeah, because when we do pass through the tail of a comet or the debris cloud, we get then hundreds of
thousands of
meteors just from that comet. So, which means that when it was first discovered in 1807, Vesta was thought to be a moon of its larger cousin Ceres, which was initially designated a planet, is... fiction. Well, you know what they thought?
No. Well, I would have got it right.
They designated Ceres and Pallas and Vesta as planets, as well as a fourth object, Juno. So
Juno.
Vesta was actually the fourth asteroid discovered. Ceres was the first. And the technical name of Vesta is Four Vesta. Fourth object discovered. Ceres was one Ceres. They were all four were designated as planets. And they thought initially that they were the remains of a destroyed planet, that the asteroid belt used to be a planet, and then it broke up into these four bigger objects.
And then they started
to discover lots of other asteroids. You know, they realized it was a whole donut of objects, not just those four. And eventually they were downgraded to nothing, and then Ceres was upgraded recently to a dwarf planet. Vesta, although it's not a dwarf planet now, is not categorically out of the running, and it may one day, and in fact, based upon the data we collect with the Dawn probe, may get upgraded to a dwarf planet. It depends on its shape. It's like pumpkin-shaped is what they're saying. So it's a little distorted, but it's also... something about its geology, you know, whether or not it will qualify as a dwarf planet. But it's not too small or anything to qualify, necessarily.
Fascinating.
Isn't that cool?
Yeah. It is, yeah.
Whatever.
So, the Dawn probe will get there in July. Then it's going to go into really close orbit around Vesta and take some very close pictures. It'll get to within about 125 miles of the surface, which is close.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The average diameter of Vesta is only about 330 miles. So it's closer to the surface than the diameter of the object. And then after it studies Vesta for a while, it's going to go on to Ceres.
Yeah, why not?
Yeah.
In the neighborhood.
Well, it's still a long way off.
Because
they're not near each other in the asteroid belt. So it's going to take... couple years, you know, to get over to Ceres. This is the first NASA probe that's actually going to go into orbit around more than one object.
Oh, that is interesting.
Yeah.
Really?
It will go into orbit around Vesta, then it will go into orbit around Ceres. Yeah.
Because the gravitational pull isn't so much that it can't get away from
Vesta. Right. That's part of it, because those are small objects. Yeah. Pretty cool.
That is pretty cool. What's cooler is that I won and you all lost.
That is not nearly as cool, I assure you.
Good for you, Rebecca.
You robbed me of a clean sweep, Rebecca.
I would probably take a bit more pride in this if I hadn't have just basically guessed.
Yeah.
You know,
it was pretty much just a crapshoot there.
But we've all been
I'll take this one.
I'm sure my analysis helped you a little bit.
We've all been there.
A bit. Actually, yeah, because when Steve first read it out, I actually thought that 1 and 3 were the most out there. So when Bob narrowed it down to 2 or 3, I realized it must be 3. That was my thinking.
Some sound reasoning.
That's Rebecca's razor.
Yep.
All right. Jay, you got a quote for us this week?
This is a quote from a man named Ian Rowland, and he wrote a book. He wrote a book called The Full Facts Book of Cold Reading.
Yeah.
It says here he's a writer and an entertainer that lives outside of London.
That's correct.
And this quote was sent in by Sariel Thrawn from Sydney, Australia. In cases where prior knowledge is available, the alternative to an open mind is not a closed mind. It is an informed mind. In such contexts, any appeal to keep an open mind is an appeal to prefer ignorance over knowledge. This is not advisable.
Excellent.
Mm-hmm. Wait.
Wait for it.
Ian Rowland!
Well, quick announcement. We'd like to send congratulations to our friends, Matt Stone and Trey Parker, for winning 9 Tony Awards for their awesome musical, The Book of Mormon, or Book of Mormon, I should say.
By friends, wow. You mean people we had on our podcast once.
Exactly. Well, one of them.
Oh, no, Rebecca. Hey, Rebecca, Evan thinks he's friends with them.
My dear buddies, Matt and Trey, or M&T as I call them.
I'd like to give a shout out to our good friend, Jimmy Carter. I'm just going to say, yo, what's up, Jimbo?
Yeah.
He still hates Jews, but I love him. So,
another quick announcement. I will be in Phoenix, Arizona, Tuesday, June 21st, starting at 7 p.m. in BJ's Brew House. This is the Phoenix Skeptics in the Pub. So if you are in the area, come and see me. I don't get out to Arizona very often. You can check out the details further at meetup.com/skepticsinphoenix/events.
Yeah, and don't forget, what's coming up. Tam, maybe?
The Amazing Meeting 9, Tam 9 from Outer Space.
Nine.
We got so much stuff going on there. It's going to be fun.
And SkeptiCon in Minneapolis, June 30th to July 3rd.
Well, thanks for the invitation, Rebecca.
It's going to be hot, I hear.
Mm-hmm. It's going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah, guys, don't forget that we are producing a SGU24 podcast, which means that we're going to be recording a live video and audio podcast that's going to be on September 23rd to 24th. And we're looking forward to getting to work on that right after TAM. We're going to be doing all the pre-production and everything. And please give us your ideas and support. Thank you.
September 23rd, 8 p.m. Thank you for joining me this week, everyone.
Thanks, Steve. What the hell was
early?
See you in 2 days.
So long.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. You can also check out our other podcast, the SGU 5x5, as well as find links to our blogs and the SGU forums. For questions, suggestions and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by leaving us a review on iTunes, Zune or your portal of choice.